Before we go into today's conversation, I wanted to let you know that it does cover personal experiences of eating disorders, addiction, and racism. This includes one incidence of a racial slur in my guest's personal testimony. So if you're likely to be negatively affected by any of these themes, please do proceed with caution and see the show notes for details of organisations who may be able to help. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance and self-image. What kind of relationship do they have with their face and body? How have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is chef, broadcaster, and author Andy Oliver. In the 1980s, Andy performed alongside her best friend Nenna Cherry in the band Rip Rig and Panic, and can count an appearance on legendary sitcom The Young Ones among her claims to fame. Her cookery journey has taken her from food truck, pop-up restaurant and string of pubs to TV appearances on Saturday Kitchen and The Great British Menu, first as a judge, then from 2017 as its presenter. She also presented a podcast with her daughter, the broadcaster Makita Oliver. Known for her warmth, intelligence and humour, Andy is a bona fide national treasure. She was also one of the very first faces I was paid to put makeup on. More of that later. And usually she's joining us remotely today as she's at home recovering from a routine operation. So when better to talk to her about her relationship with her body? Welcome, Andy Oliver. And thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Clinique, where great-looking skin begins. Andy, thank you. How are you feeling in recovery there?
I'm feeling pretty good. I've taken the summer off, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's been this incredibly long summer. I'm about to just kick into work gear again now, actually. But it's been interesting. It's been really good for me to just have to stop. And for somebody like me, it's generally an enforced thing because I'm not very good at doing it of my own accord. So it's,
I mean, sometimes it feels like divine intervention, doesn't it? Like something is forcing you.
Yes. And it's good to look at your body and, you know, intimately have a proper relationship with it. Like, if your knee's hurting, get it sorted. If not now, when? You know, what am I going to do, wait for another 10 years and then it'd be even more difficult to get over? So, you know, it's good for me to do those things and look after
We're going to come back to your aches, pains and general thoughts around aging, I'm sure. But I want to start, as I so often do, because I think mothers are so influential. But in your case, I know what a big deal, what a big person, a big character your mother is. So tell me about her.
She's amazing, my mum, actually. She's 88 now, and she lives here with us. We all live together in the same house, which I'm so happy about. I really am, because I think, actually, talking about physical frailty, she's not frail yet, but she's more frail than she was before. She still walks the whole length of the high street every day. She's not on any medication. She's quite a kind of trooper. Somebody said to me the other day, "Your mum makes me really nervous." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "She's just never impressed by anything. She's, you know what I mean? You can sort of say, like, I'll make her some amazing dinner." I'm like, "How's that, mum?" She's like, "It's quite nice." She's very sort of sanguine about everything, you know. But then when she gives you praise, when she says, "That's great," or "You've done brilliantly," you really appreciate it, because, you know, she really, really means it. She doesn't praise faintly. It's always because she really, really means it. She never says anything she doesn't mean, which I get from her, actually. And that was a really important life lesson for me. You know, don't bullshit. Don't chat.
Yeah.
Fart, as they used to say. But it's like, it's actually very good for your health to not say things you don't mean. I have found in my younger life, when I was much more of a people pleaser and more inclined to go along with things, or, you know, just kind of try to shore up the difference between who I was and who people expected me to be or who they wanted me to be and all of that stuff. Since I stopped doing all those things in the last couple of decades or whatever, my health is better. My emotional and mental health is a million times better, because you're not constantly walking a tightrope of trying to hold your breath and trying to get it right for anybody else.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And you also shed the people who bullshit you.
Exactly.
Which is also good for your health.
Which is also really good for your health. You know, when you're young, you spend a lot of time with people you don't even really want to be with. You know, I've got a friend who was constantly saying to me, oh, I've got to go and have lunch with so-and-so. I don't really like her. And I was like, why are you going for lunch with these people that you don't like? Well, I'd rather have lunch on my own.
So then go and have lunch with people I don't like.
Do you know what I mean? Or just read a book or do something else. And I think that, you know, the world is... Well, hang on a second. Is that a dog? Oh, it's a dog on the outside door trying to get in.
That's all right.
Trying to get out.
We welcome all dogs at all times.
There's all sorts of dogs. There's dogs all over. There's three dogs in this house and they're driving me nuts. I think that lesson from my mother has been a bit like a cornerstone for me. It's like a touchstone. It's like something I go back to all the time for clarity and for purpose and for peace of mind, you know. And I think that my mum was a teacher for years. She taught primary school, reception class. And you know, she's an amazing teacher, the kind of teacher whereby if you were at her house before she moved in, the door would knock and there'd be some massive guy there with his Mrs. Oliver here, with a kind of six-year-old. He's like, I brought my little Tommy to meet Mrs. Oliver because she taught me when I was little and I wanted him to meet her. Like, people loved
her. Wow.
And I went to Bury St. Edmunds, which is where I grew up from the age of about 10 or something, one time with a friend of mine. He was doing a show at the Theatre Royal in town centre. And he said, oh, I'm here with my friend Andy Oliver. And she, you know, she grew up here, blah, blah, blah. And she said, her mum, and my mum was with us. And he said, and she's here with her mum, Mrs. Oliver. And I know she was a teacher. What did she teach any of you? And half the audience got up and gave my mum a standing ovation in the theatre. And I was like, mum! And she was absolutely in shock. I was so proud of her. Because to be a teacher who impacts people like that is to be a precious jewel in the world, I think.
And how much were appearances part of that? I know that your childhood was very much a sort of game of two halves, in that you had this kind of blissful 3.5 years in Cyprus, right?
I did.
Where I think you didn't feel different. You felt completely accepted and part of your Cyprus life. And then you land in this very middle class, white, middle England, Bury St. Edmunds. Tell me about that and that transition and how that impacted how people treated you and how you felt.
That was, I think, a kind of trigger point in my life, like a trauma point for sure.
Right.
Because I came back and for a start, the first thing that I remember about it was that it was dark. It's really weird. Because the
climate,
light,
you mean, it was just grey and dark.
And we went to Norfolk, then we went to Suffolk, and it was just dark and rainy. I feel like we came back in like February or something, which was not ideal, obviously. And people were calling me names, racist names. There were
almost straight away,
almost immediately. We went to Bryce Norton Airport. We came back to the RAF airport because my dad was in the RAF, and somebody called me a wog in the airport. I remember it.
Wow.
And also they gave me powdered scrambled eggs is the other thing I remember. You see what I mean about trauma? Powdered scrambled eggs and being called racist names, just awful. And then I was just in Bury, and Bury was a very weird place. It was really, I call that time in England before they found the light switch. It's like before they put the lights on. Everything was a bit grim and a bit grey.
What year are we in, Andy?
We are 73, 73, 74. It's about 1974, and it's a long time ago, obviously. And it was it was a very different country, but to a lot. Weirdly, there are echoes of that NF racist stuff happening now, which I find very disturbing. We'll talk about that later. But
of course.
And actually, one of the reasons I find it so distressing is because I remember it from the 70s. I'm like, not
and being a little
again.
Girl.
I'm being a little yeah. girl and just feeling so yeah. helpless and so adrift and so lost. And so that's when I started to really feel like I was rejecting myself. Like there was a sort of I kind of disassociated, I think, from my body and what was happening and what was going on in my head. There were like three different Andes almost. It's interesting because I've spoken about this before and I get a very interesting reaction. Lots of people go, this sounds awful. What, you know, the normal responses you would imagine. And then some people go, stupid woman, shut up, stop going on about it. It's like, wow. So it's like people want you to reject the truth of your own experience and they want us to shut up about it. They don't want to hear about it. They don't think we should be talking about it, because I think the very nature of giving it voice feels for some people like an accusation. And I don't see it as an accusation. Speaking my truth it's just what has to happen. It's not because I'm blaming somebody else or telling them they have to do anything about it.
I very much want you to go on about it.
Yeah, no, I know.
That's
you
literally
do.
What I mean. So I would love to know in that case, when you talk about that experience, if it started to damage your kind of self, your sense of self, your sense of value, how did that show up in your behavior, your appearance, your life?
I think that's when I actually started to rely on my wit and being quick-witted was really, yeah. really, really important, because I felt like I had to stay at least five steps ahead of everybody else so that they couldn't catch me. So I was constantly moving. It's interesting, actually, because it goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. I was constantly moving, never able to really settle. I didn't ever really feel safe. And I think if you don't feel safe, I think that made me quite aggressive. I think it made me really distrustful of most people, because I never knew when people were going to turn. That was a real issue for me. So I'd be talking to somebody and then they'd suddenly say something really awful, like, oh, well, I had a teacher who used to call me "you people." I would say, oh, I like to dance. And she'd go, well, you people do, don't you? Literally.
Oh, wow, okay.
She just used to call me "you people" all the time. Anything I said, "you people, you people, you people." And every time she said it, I would get a little bit smaller and feel a little bit more broken and a little bit more isolated and a little bit more lost. I had two friends, Sue and Louise, who were my dear, I knew lots of people, but they were my best friends.
Those are very
friends.
1970s names.
Sue and Louise. Friends. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sue, yeah. Sue Weiberg and Louise Buxton. I love them both still. And we were like a little trio, you know, and if I hadn't had Sue and Louise, I don't know what I would have done, because they just held me together. We held each other together, young girlfriends. But I think the disassociation, the kind of anxiety that created, meant that I was just in a constant state of panic, like all the time. I just was panicking all the time that somebody was going to notice that I was black, somebody was going to notice that I was different. So I was constantly trying to make myself fit into some mold that would make me shrink or diminish so that people didn't notice that I was different. But
would you do that?
Well, it's a kind of, there's a weird duality to it. That's what I mean by I think I sort of split into all these things, because there was a bit of me also that wanted to be different. So if the teacher was going, you know, when the teacher goes out of the class and they go, oh, I need somebody to keep reading, I'd be like, me, me. Nobody else ever wanted to do it. I'd be like, I want to do it. And it'd be like, does anybody else want to do it? And be like, no. So I would always be first up front of the class. I was into it. I was into getting on the stage. I was into being at the front. Get that light on me. Let me show you what I can do. I was into that totally. But outside of that, I was waiting for rejection and was just terrified all the time. So I made myself funny. I made myself quick. I made myself ahead of everybody else. And inside I was dying.
And since you've said so much of that poor treatment you were receiving and bullying and horrible comments were related directly to your race.
Yes.
How did that leave your young relationship with your own blackness?
Oh, terrible. I hated being black. I didn't want to be black. I just wanted... Oh, my God, these dogs managed to break in. I didn't want to be black. I wanted to be white. I would walk around... Is that not annoying, that noise of the dog?
It's fine.
It's a dog, people, just in case you're wondering what that weird noise is. It's my dog, Scout. I rejected my blackness. I resented my blackness. I wanted to be a different kind of black. I wanted to be light-skinned. I wanted to have lots of long, curly, like mixed race hair. I wanted to be a different kind of black. I didn't want to look African black. I felt like if I was going to be black, I wanted to look like the American girls on telly with loads of glamour and stuff. And I just seemed to look like a little very dark black girl with short hair. And that's not how I wanted to look. I wanted to look like Farrah Fawcett Majors, you know what I mean? Or Audrey Hepburn. these were my options.
When did that start to change for you?
I guess when I first came to London, it started to... You know what happened? Punk happened.
So that's what I was really wanting to get onto, because I know what a big deal that was in your life. So you kind of dropped out of school before O-levels, right? Same as me.
Yeah, essentially. And I was done.
Moved into a squat.
I did take a couple of O-levels, but there really wasn't much point because I was barely there. Do you know what I mean? I was like, I'm done. I've fucking had enough. And I think 2 years before I came down, the Slits came to Bury St. Edmunds. And the Slits and the Clash played at the Corn Exchange in Bury St. Edmunds. I don't even know what year it was, but it was one of those moments I can actually remember, the moment that the world fractured and changed again. And it was like the Slits came on stage. There was Ari, there was Tessa, there was Palm Olive, there was Viv. I was like, what is happening? I need this so desperately. They sang Typical Girls. And I was like, yes, yes. And I just was like, because it was like all of the anxiety, all of the wildness in me that had been kind of, I've been trying to hold in to try to fit into this kind of suburban Bury St. Edmunds tiny little shape that just was not working, because I just was never that person. Just went, it was like the alien, you know, when he comes bursting out of the tummy in the alien. And I was sort of born in that moment, I feel. And then the Clash came on.
It must have been so freeing.
Oh, my God.
If you were a young girl who, for whatever reason, had been othered in her kind of regional community, punk must have felt like an almost religious experience.
It was like being anointed.
Yeah.
It really was. It was absolutely like a religious experience. And it was a religion in some way, you know. It was because it took my soul and it took my heart and it nurtured me, it carried me. It's interesting because people see punk in a much more kind of, I mean, yes, it was quite macho and there were all those things, but there was something about it that was so liberating because you could be whoever you wanted. It wasn't you had to fit into a uniform, you had to have your hair like this. You could just wear whatever you wanted, be whoever you wanted. You know, I had a carrot bag for a dress at one point, this big orange carrot bag. We just cut the corners off and I just put it on and my mate just slashed a hole in the top. I wish I had a picture. It was the best dress ever. And we found a guy. I literally the next day started, changed all my clothes. I was like, I'm not wearing any of this shit anymore. I'm a punk now.
So you have this kind of very fast metamorphosis into this
overnight.
Other physical being. So what did you look like?
Well, there was the carrot bag dress. There was, and then we found a guy in the back of Bury. It was like an old shop in the back of the town. And he had winkle pickers, like from the 50s, in boxes in the back, proper silk and satin winkle pickers.
Wow.
Absolutely incredible, like golds and greens and in wild design. And he used to sell them to us for 90p. So we would go in there every week and buy a new pair, wear them out, go to some gig. They'd get totally trashed. We'd throw them away and go and buy another pair. The next week, you know, we started shopping in all the secondhand shops and stuff. So it, I used to wear my dad's cricket jumper as a dress. I used to wear my mum's bedroom curtain wrapped around. The first thing I ever wore on stage at the venue in Victoria was my mum's bedroom curtain, which was, it was a very nice curtain. It was like a dark plum damask. So it had inlaid gold. And so I wrapped it around me and put a couple of pins in it. And then I had a big head tie and everybody was like, wow, that dress is amazing. I was like, thank you very much. So it just gave you license to be creative and wild and free. And the more inventive you were, the stronger and taller you felt. And that's actually because prior to that, everything that happened felt like it was diminishing me and crushing me down. And punk happened and I felt like taller and taller and like my lungs expanded and I could breathe and start to become myself. And it really literally saved my life. It was a movement of not just liberation, but medicine for me. You know, it literally changed everything. And then I came down to London and I met Nana. And Nana had been in Sweden. I mean, she was in New York and did this other groovy stuff for her, which saved her life. But she was also grew up in a tiny little town in Sweden that was very like Bury St. Edmunds. So we were like, oh, this shit. We knew, we recognized each other immediately and had the similar battles with our blackness and with our sense of self and who we were and being other and different and just wanting to be like a little blonde white girl. So we kind of saw each other and held on to each other for dear life, you know.
I mean, it's sort of mad to think of her thinking that way. I mean, I think yes. She's sort of widely regarded as a kind of one of the all-time great raving beauties, yes, isn't she? It's like it's so mad to think of her thinking that, you know, she wasn't a pretty thing. I mean, she's devastatingly good looking.
That's the thing about dysmorphia. Dysmorphia is not based in fact. You know, when I see pictures of us back then, I was like, what, you know, even then what we thought we looked like, the size that we thought we were back then, all of that stuff is insane. It's, you know, and I just think it's very sad how much time we spend in our lives wishing we were in a different body, wishing we were in somebody else's body or looked like some other human being or person, you know.
Well, because now, I mean, I'm 50, you're older than me, but as we get older, that is the time where you look at your body and you think, God love you for bringing me as far
as
you have.
Thank you, thank
you. It sort of deserves your respect.
And love and gratitude and care and you know, nurture. It's like, oh my God, I'm sorry. I've apologised to my body for the way that I treated it and the terrible things I've said about it and the terrible ways that I felt about it. You know, it does break my heart somewhat at this point in my life when I look back and, you know, think about what I've been through with my own relationship.
I want to talk about that because you've been so generous in how candid you've been about the ups and downs you've had with your body. You've talked quite openly about this. I know your brother died very young of sickle cell.
Yeah.
And this sort of kick-started a really serious mental health episode that showed up in your body, right?
Yeah, I developed a really serious eating disorder.
As much as you feel comfortable talking about it, tell me about that, because I think it's a side of eating disorders that are much less talked about because we don't have a skinny 15-year-old girl in massive jeans on the front page of a newspaper.
All eating disorders have shame attached to them, but compulsive eating disorder, people are more disgusted by, and people still say, why don't you just go on a diet? It's like, you're not eating because you're hungry. You're eating because you're ill. Do you know what I mean? It's like I got so ill that I was sitting in the dark in a room eating, crying, and wanting to make myself sick, but not even being able to do that. So feeling so scared, so lost, so trapped, and so ashamed. The shame is the most crushing part of it for me. that was the most crushing part of it, the shame that I couldn't stop because I just felt like I was disgusting. I didn't know I was ill. I didn't know I was ill for quite a long time because
and
nobody...
what was it? Not that these things are ever neat, but of course they're not linear, but
yeah,
you must have had such big and complicated feelings during that time and so grief-stricken and so bereft and must have brought up a lot for you.
Yes.
How did that show up in your diet and what were the kind of behaviours?
The behaviour was secretly eating. And almost like in a, almost sometimes like really like almost a bit of a trance, to be honest with you, like not just disordered eating, like, oh, I'll have another bit of toast, more like getting up in the night, in the dark, half asleep and just standing in the fridge and just sticking food into my mouth. You know,
and what would happen? You temporarily feel nothing or what would happen?
While I was eating, you mean? It was like, I suppose it's like, if you need a fag or you need a drink and that damps down the feelings for a brief 20 minutes or half an hour or whatever it does. So I would go through that and then get back into bed and then wake up in the morning feeling like, oh my God, I got up in the night and I was eating again in the night and just like it happened to somebody else almost, you know what I mean?
Like sleepwalking almost.
A little bit, but I was, it's like in a, sort of being in a kind of half in and out sort of state. And then I'd walk around all day and in the back of my head, I'd be obsessing about what I'd had and what I shouldn't have and what I might be able to have later and what I probably shouldn't eat in front of other people. And, you know, because I was always conscious of the fact that, I felt like everybody was always watching me to find out what I was going to eat and what I was not going to eat. And people do, if you're very big, and I got very big then because I was eating a lot of food, I was putting away a lot of calories, and people are very judgmental about what you eat and what you don't eat. Like, they'll eat the same and they'll be side-eyeing you while you're eating, so you feel really ashamed about putting any food in your mouth in front of other people. So then you think, well, I'll eat on my own. You eat on your own and then it gets out of control. So It's a horrible cycle, the main engine of which is the shame. And it went on for quite a long time. The reason I came to understand that I was ill and not disgusting was that a friend of mine was a heroin addict. And she came out of treatment and I went to see her. She'd been in a terrible state. Her children were taken away. She had went through an awful, terrible thing. And I went to see her and she was telling me about what being in treatment had been like. And she was like, well, I went in and they took the, you know, I wasn't allowed to have anything. And, you know, she talked to me about the therapy and all these things. And I said to her, wow, I wish you could do that for food, really, really quietly. And she went, you can do that for food. And I went, what? I had no idea. I'd never heard of a compulsive eating disorder. I'd heard of anorexia and I'd heard of bulimia. I'd never heard of anything else. Now they call it disordered eating and it's a broader sort of brushstroke. But I'd never heard of compulsive eating being a disorder. As far as I was concerned, I couldn't stick to a diet and I was disgusting. It was as simple as that. And she said, no, you can. And I was like, well, I don't understand. So she said, I think you should go and see my doctor. And she took me.
An addiction specialist.
Yes. And she took me to see this incredible man called Dr. Robert Lefevre. And I sat down with him and he asked me questions about what I was. And it was the first time I'd given voice to anybody. The first time I told anybody what had been happening. And he said, what happens for you? And I told him the things I'm telling you, that I get up in the night or I, you know, wait for nobody else to be there. And then I'll eat loads of food. And then I just sit and I cry and I cry and I cry and I cry. And my heart is broken and my soul is broken and I'm terrified, basically. And he said, yeah, you need help. You're ill. And it was like the biggest relief of my life.
Such validation, isn't it?
I was for like, someone oh to my acknowledge God, there's actually something wrong. Yeah. I can get better. Because the terror, and I really was struggling with suicidal ideation and all sorts of, I was really frightened, Sally. It was horrible. It's the worst,
and how
darkest
old were you,
period
Andy,
of my
at
life.
This point?
Sorry, how old was I?
Yeah.
I was 26.
Right. So that's a difficult age anyway. Yeah. You're getting to know
I was
yourself.
26.
It's a lot.
My brother died. He was 27. I was 26. So this is between the ages of 26 and 28, probably, that this was happening. And then when I was coming up to 28 was when I met Dr. Lefevre, I think, 27, 28.
But the thing about food addiction is sort of unlike any other addiction in that you need it.
Yeah, you have to have it several times a day.
You have to have it.
It's not like being an alcoholic. You can't have three shots of whiskey a day. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't expect an alcoholic to be able to do that.
Quite that. But also what makes your recovery even more remarkable is that you ended up working in food. I mean, you're basically an alcoholic who's running a pub.
Yeah.
You know, you're a heroin addict who's a poppy farmer. You know, like what? That's so odd and challenging and brave.
But do you know what? It's also, you see, the thing is, before it went tits up, basically, before it went dark, cooking and food were my joy. So since I was like 10, 11, 12 years old, I was cooking dinner for my friends. I was quite
Is it how you show love to people?
Yeah. And what I understood really early on was that you can transform a moment with food, that you can make someone's life, their day, a little bit beautiful. You can make that corner of the day, you can bring light into their eyes and into their heart. And, you know, there's not one of the things that great joys in my life is to make somebody something to eat and watch them eat it and watch them change physically. Like, you can feel that you light them up from the inside. And I think it's such a gift. And my dad was an incredible cook. And, you know, it's something that's in my family. So food and conviviality and hosting and bringing people together, and all of those things were a really important part of my happiness and my joy and my relationships with other people. And then that became inverted in my mental health crisis and turned into the darkness, you know, turned into all of the stuff that I've just described. And then finding my way back out with Dr. Lefevre, meant that I stepped back into the light again and I could reclaim my joy.
Yeah, it's interesting because you were somebody who used food to show your love for other people, but also used food to show your lack of love for yourself.
Yes, to torture myself. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think life's a bit like that. I think that things can turn on a coin, on a kind of knife edge. You know, I think that what is joyful and ecstatic at times can slip over into dysfunction and destruction quite easily. Love can do the same. Do you know what I mean? You know, you can be having a really passionate, incredible relationship with somebody, and then you suddenly realize that actually that passion has now become dysfunction, and you're just mistaking conflict for passion. You know, and I think that extreme feelings or powerful feelings always have the possibility of that they can you can turn onto the wrong edge, and that's why you can't ever really be complacent about anything and never take things for granted. I think you have to really examine what you're doing each time, come to it anew, and really examine the intention of what you're embarking upon. Why? That's what I always go to when I'm doing anything. Why am I doing this? What is it I want to achieve? Because if you don't know, then what are we doing here? You know.
Let's take a quick pause on this episode to thank our series sponsor, Clinique. Clinique believes that great-looking skin doesn't have to be complicated, and obviously I quite agree. Over 50 years ago, Clinique changed the beauty industry forever by being one of the first to offer a dermatologist-developed skincare ritual outside of the dermatologist's office, the iconic three-step routine: cleanse, exfoliate, and moisturise. Clinique was the first premium brand I ever owned, and truly, there hasn't ever been a single time in over 3.5 decades since where I haven't had something Clinique in my bathroom cabinet. From the original Clinique computer that helped women understand their skin, to today's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool, Clinique has always led the way in helping you to truly understand what your skin needs. They offer solutions for every skin type and concern, and Clinique's makeup and skincare products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Discover your best skin at Clinique, where great-looking skin begins. I want to talk to you about how that self-image then changed and moved into television with you. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned at the top there that I had worked with you as a teenager. You were one of the first faces I ever had to put makeup on. And the reason we were doing that is that you were presenting a pilot for a music show called Native Tongues for mainstream terrestrial television that didn't get commissioned. And when you and I talked about this previously, you mentioned that you were rejected for an absolutely straightforwardly racist decision. Tell me about that, because that takes us into the rest of your telling.
Yeah, they said it was a brilliant pilot, actually. It was really incredible. It was really interesting. We had all these amazing artists on it. We got my friend Eamon Walker to read a piece from an August Wilson play. He did this place right down the barrel of the camera. It was really innovative, like really amazing television making. And it was quite exciting. I remember the whole thing. And then when it didn't get commissioned, no one could believe it. And the broadcaster literally said, "It's too black. We're not going to make it because it's too black." And it was so
Which is something you could say then.
Something you could say
then. With no repercussions.
With no repercussions. And I mean, I'll be very honest. The same stuff happens now. They just talk around it in a very different way. They'll go, "Oh, it's a bit niche," is what they say now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I know.
It's not broad in its appeal.
Yeah, it's like, you know, well, people say things like, "Oh, well, that doesn't look like they did any dinner party I went to." I'm like, I can't help it. If you've got dry mates, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you. So, you know, things get rejected for all sorts of reasons, but that was quite a heartbreaking one, actually, because it would have been a brilliant show, and it was a really, like, now they would probably make it, I think, because it was extraordinary. But you know, that is the nature of television as well. You put your heart and soul into things, and they just don't come through, and that happens for all kinds of reasons. But I think that. You can't ever let these things, I don't ever let those things deter me or determine what my next move might be. Because if you allow yourself to be governed by other people's limitations or other people's mediocrity, then what we're doing, I ask the same question again, what we're doing here, do you know what I mean? And I think I've never done anything because I wanted to be rich. I've never done anything because, well, obviously, I've never done anything thinking, great, I'll just make loads of money, or, right, I'm going to do that because then I'll get successful. I do things because of the artistic desire to do them. And that's always led me, it's never steered me wrong. And whenever I don't do that, I end up in some sticky situation and I'm always pissed off. So at this point in my life, at 62, I go, I don't want to do it. I don't like it. I don't like that guy's face or whatever. Like, the energy's wrong. The vibe is wrong. Why is that guy looking at me? I'm not going to do it. He freaks me out. And people will go, "Oh, Andy," like, something a few years ago, they wanted me to go into business with somebody who's quite well known. And I said, no, I don't trust him. And everybody was like, "Andy, what are you talking about? This is a massive opportunity. You could have a string of restaurants across the country with this guy, blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "It smells weird. I'm not doing it." And I didn't do it. About 6 months later, this guy started kicking off all over the place. And everybody was going, "Oh my God, you really?" And I said, "I fucking told you. I could just smell it on him." Do you know what I mean? I don't trust people who shout at people who can't shout back. You know what I mean? It's like, if you're going to shout at me, don't shout at some poor little runner. What are you doing? Stop it immediately. I just don't like that kind of behavior. So I just think I have to go with my gut on everything, because my gut steers me right every time.
But as much as the media has ostensibly changed, has changed, has also pretendy changed, you
pretendy
know, all the things,
changed.
You know, as much as we've just sort of talked about that, the fact is you are a super mainstream presenter in terms of the channels you appear on, the times your shows go out. You are a mainstream celebrity now. You are a 62-year-old black woman who's not stick thin. Mm-hmm. And so how do you feel about that? Do you take that seriously? Those jobs are few and far between. Does it give you an extra sense of responsibility, if you like?
I take it very seriously, Sally, actually.
Talk to me about that.
Well, like you just said, I'm a 62-year-old bald black woman who is not stick thin. And I think that having me in a position of respected authority in the culinary world is really important, because we're trying to change the culinary world and we're trying to change perceptions of excellence. We're trying to change the way that culture and is valued and celebrated and uplifted. We're trying to change the way that we're trying to change that throughout every facet of society, aren't we? You are with your work, I am with my work, you know, all of our peers and all the people we know, we're all really working to shift that paradigm, aren't we? Shift the way that the world views women, gender, sex, race, culture, everything. So the more of us that are out there, the more of me's that are out there, the more of you's, the more of us that are out there doing the work that we do. And me and Nikita call it accidental politics. So it's like, yeah. I don't have to be on Great British Menu going, here I am, 62, and I'm black, and look at my ass all the time. All I have to do is show up and be excellent. So I show up and I'm fucking excellent on purpose. Do you know what I mean? Be excellent on purpose. That's what I say. Give it everything. Be better. Be absolutely brilliant at what you do. Show up on time. Be professional. Treat people well. Do it with love. Do it because you care. Do it for your art. Do your homework. Get some rest. Show up. And 200% of you, show up. Show up right. Show up good. Show up strong. And I love that. I love the feeling that that gives me.
Everybody loves you. I mean, there are very, you're one of those people that just kind of, that is just universally loved and appealing.
Oh,
one of the things that's happened to you that is quite interesting, because we are talking about your self-image and how you felt when you were younger versus now. And I don't even know if you want to address this, but I'm going to force you to address it. Lots of people really, really fancy you. So I know loads and loads of men and women who go, craw, Andy Oliver off the telly. I really fancy her. And you sort of, I don't think many people expect to become an object of desire when they're 62. And, you know, you must know that. You must know that that's happened. It's a funny one, isn't it, that at anyone's age over 35.
I'm not really conscious of the fancying bit. I'm conscious
you're
a
sex symbol.
Oh my God, no, I'm not really conscious of that. Honestly, Sally, I'm not. But what I am conscious of is people like being attracted to me, like in a in a broader sort of sense.
Yeah,
and I'm also conscious of the fact that most women my age have exactly the opposite experience.
Right,
where they feel less and less visible. So I am very aware that my getting older experience is really different to that most of my girlfriends go through. Yeah, and that's quite interesting to me, because people keep saying, "Oh, I want to talk to you about, you know, feelings of invisibility as you get older." And I'm like, I'm not the one, mate. I that's not happened to me. I don't really know what that feels like. And I actually feel more visible now, and I feel sexier, and I feel more attractive, and my and I think, you know, it just goes to show you that actually attraction is, a lot of it is about confidence. So my confidence has grown so much. My sense of self is so much stronger. And I think that's probably what people feel is they are attracted to, because that's just nice to be around, isn't it? We all want to be around people who have a strong sense of themselves and who feel confident, but also
confidence
are able to be
and
vulnerable.
Charm.
Yeah.
Confidence, charm, charisma, reality, honesty, those things are sexy.
Yeah,
of course.
I think so generally in the world, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? Interestingly, and I guess, you know, delightfully, the more you step into those shoes, the more I step into those shoes, the happier I am. You know, so it's great that all those things correlate. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, I love that I'm now in a place in my career where I can, you know, really explore my intellect and the things that really interest me, you know, literature, books, you know, doing the book show and working with writers and doing all of those things. It's just joyful to me. You know, at the beginning you said a chef, a singer, broadcaster, author. Whenever anybody says author, I go... author, you know. I mean, you've written loads of books. I've written one book. I'm writing a new one now, actually. And I...
My thoughts and prayers.
I love
My
it.
My sympathies.
I love writing, Sally. I absolutely love it. And, I, you know, books, you know, we were talking about how I survived all that disconnect and the disassociation when I was much younger. Books were my mainstay. You know, they were my way of stepping out. Books and cider were my mainstays, really. Strongbow and books, a healthy diet of Strongbow and books. But I... But books were my way of accessing other worlds and accessing other universes, other bodies, other communities, other ways of living, other ways of thinking and being. And so to at this point, have when I published that book, it was such a huge moment for me to see my thoughts on paper in a, you know, in, it's, I say with them, a book. I still go past it and go, written a book, you know, it's a joyful thing to me. So
there's one thing you've brought through kind of every iteration of your career and your life as a woman, really, is this kind of punk energy. You are bald, as you said. That is a very subversive thing for a woman to be, and for a mature woman in the public eye to be. Tell me about that. What does that mean? It's also a big thing for a black woman to be. Hair
yes.
is important.
Yes.
Hair is important to black women,
yes.
by and large.
Yeah, no shit. It's very important to black women. But my hair is quite, well, it's weak. It breaks a lot. It's bits of it come. I was just like, I'm fucking done with this. I'm shaving it off. I was like, it was too much like hard work. And we've had this conversation before. I am not a high maintenance beauty upkeep person. I can't be asked, Sally. It's like, I would have had to be in all the time, like plaiting and I quite like getting it plaited. I didn't like having to have loads of treatments. I didn't like having to worry about whether I was going to get a bald spot. I didn't want to have to worry. So I shaved it off years ago. The first time I ever shaved it, was me and we were on tour, Rip, Rick and Panic. We were in Glasgow, I think, or Manchester, one or the other. And my hair had been breaking and I was really pissed off with it and I'd been moaning about it. And Nana was like, oh my God, either shave it off or shut up. So I went, shave it. And she went, really? I went, yeah. So we went to Boots and bought some razors and soaked up my head and we just shaved it off. And then I put a head tie on and we didn't tell anybody in the band. And we went on stage and we're like flying around on stage and the head tie sort of swirled off and I was completely bald. And all the guys went, oh, my God. It was just... And it's liberating.
Yeah, so I had a very similar conversation with Candice Brathwaite in a previous series. Because, yeah, she's great. And she did the same thing. She shaved her head and she said, and I would imagine it's the same for you, how kind of powerful she felt in kind of taking control of that and going, no, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
Is that how you felt?
Yeah, absolutely, completely and totally. And luckily I've got quite a neat head. So I don't have a lumpy head.
Yeah, it does help.
It does help. Quite a small, neat head does go quite a lot of, does help enormously. But you're also, there's something about, you're left with your face. There's nowhere to hide and there's nothing between you and the world. There's nothing to distract from just your face. And something about that does make you feel quite goddess-like. At times.
Yeah,
it can do. I mean, somebody was going to me, yeah, but you've got a good face. You've got bones.
You do
face
have a good face.
So I suppose that helps. But, you know, it. I don't know. I like it. I have been thinking about growing my hair back, though.
Have you?
Yes. Mainly because I'd quite like some 1970s Cicely Tyson cane row activity. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying.
And I can see why that holds appeal.
I wouldn't
for sure.
mind a little succubus vibes happening. I'm saying succubus because I'm thinking about that Rumble in the Jungle film. And she's singing. Miriam McCabe is singing. And she's got those incredible, she's going, succubus, succubus. And she's got this incredible hair. And I was watching, I was thinking, I fancy that. So in the next year, I may grow it.
If you need a visual reference there, I believe Andy's talking about When We Were Kings, which we'll
I'm talking about When We Were Kings. No, it's Rumble in the Jungle. It's the fight was called Rumble in the Jungle. The film is
called
When
exactly.
We Were Kings.
And that's the documentary of Muhammad the fight. Ali. Brilliant. Fantastic
and
film.
Miriam Makeba sings in it. She's got this incredible hairdo. And I was like, I want that fucking plaits. I love K-Mos. But yes, we'll see. I'm thinking about it.
I think of I'm convinced that everyone kind of has at least one sort of beauty trademark. You close your eyes and you think of their trademark. And for you, not only do I think baldness and how amazing that looks on you, but do you know the other thing I think about is your beauty trademark? Eyewear.
Oh.
Yeah. You are such a good glasses wearer. As a glasses wearer myself, I really notice people's glasses. And you're like somebody who seems to delight
I love them.
In facial accessories.
Well, I was just like, oh my God, it's another thing I can buy. I was like, oh, shopping, you say? A new thing to buy. I was like, this is great. And I like how they change your face. Like each pair of glasses is a completely new, you know, it's another level of layer of jewellery, basically. I love all adornment, you know, rings and necks and that. So to me, it's just another new thing to buy. I was like, oh, great. There's a whole new world of shopping for me out there. So I've never been like, oh, no, I've got to wear glasses. I was like, oh, excellent. I've got my chains.
No,
I don't wear the chains in the summer because they get too hot on the back of my neck. But in the autumn, I'll start wearing my glasses chains. I love a glasses chain.
Yes, me too. I've got several glasses chains.
These are lovely. These are black eyewear. Black eyewear are great because they're quite bold. I like a bold frame and I like quite a good, big, strong pair of glasses. I don't look so good in like little metally ones. I need like a strong frame, Sally.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you can go stronger when you've got no hair as well.
I think you can
really
relish
in them.
Somebody's making me a bespoke pair of glasses as we speak. She's called Natalie. She's making me these wild glasses. I'm so excited about it.
Well, that's very exciting. I know. You mentioned that you're super, super high maintenance, that you're not one for a beauty treatment. You can't be asked. So what does your kind of self-care look like? Whatever self-care means to you. Are you a bather? Are you a showerer?
I don't have a bath in my house, and you know what? When I'm in a different place in my menopause now. I've been menopausal for ages, whatever. And I couldn't get in the bath. For ages, for a good few years, because every time I got in the bath, I'd have such an overwhelming hot flush. I'd get in the bath and then I'd be like, within about 10 seconds. So I just stopped having baths. But I think I might be past that. But that was pre-hormones. So now I'm on estrogen and testosterone. So that's what part of my self-care looks like. Keeping those hormones up. But you've got, I must say to everybody, if you're having testosterone, be careful because I have testosterone cream. You have to use the tiniest little nub of it. I started slapping it on because I have never been one for
moderation.
For moderation or the prescribed amount of anything. And I was like, oh, this testosterone's good. Let's whack a bit more of that on. And then I found myself getting really aggressive and really weird, like narky. And I was like, we were on tour in Scotland doing this job. And suddenly, and I was just getting like, and it was pissing me off. And I was feeling really like fucking. And then I went, oh my God, it's the testosterone. And I had to stop taking it for a couple of weeks and bring the levels back down.
And people get really oversexed as well, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, yes. Well,
really
I was going to draw a veil over that, but also, yes, humping the lamppost. I was like a lunatic. I was oversexed and aggressive, like really bad. People were talking to me and I was thinking, you look kind of hot. Like really like some weird, like
no,
weird
I have testosterone cream as well. I know that, you know, it's a delicate balance, but what you're saying is absolutely right. It's sort of, you get to an age where the most important act of self-care is to make sure your hormones are semi-stable.
Yes. And then I do my nails. All the
yes,
time.
Yes, you've always got good nails.
I've always got
so
good nails.
So do you go to a salon?
I have a beautiful girl called Shay comes to my house and does my nails. She does Cynthia Erivo's nails. She did all the nails in Wicked. And she's amazing and is the sweetest soul. And she comes to your house. It doesn't even cost you more than the salad. She's brilliant. She's not even massively expensive. She comes to the house. She does the whole family. Garfield gets his nails done. Makita, my daughter, gets his. He has pedicures. He does the whole everything. And the whole family get our nails done, apart from my mother, who refuses to let people do anything.
You have, one thing I've noticed about you, nails aside, in all the time I've known you, you have very beautiful hands,
don't you?
You have very elegant, beautiful hands, wow. I always think, which helps in TV.
It does because help you're always pointing at things. Yes. Waving them about and stuff. I love having my nails in because I used to bite my nails really badly and I never thought I'd get past it. As soon as I started having them done, I don't even put them in my mouth anymore. So this is like a dream. This is like teenage Andy's dream that I would have like manicured, beautiful nails. And I love having that done. And the other thing I do is there's a saying in the Caribbean that says, drink your water, cream your skin, mind your business. Right. So,
I mean, those are words to live by.
These are words to live by. So I drink my water, I cream my skin, and I mind my business. And I cream my skin. Now, I don't use really expensive moisturizers. I use it. My stylist, Shara, her mother, makes this cream called Drykin. And it's all natural. It's like avocado oil, shea butter, cocoa butter. And it's the most, anybody that tries it just is like, what is happening? It's like, it makes your skin like satin. It's absolutely beautiful. And I Drykin my skin like twice a day. I used to only use cocoa butter. Now I only use Drykin and I use it twice a day. I use bio oil on my scar, my knee scar and my hysterectomy scar, to stop it keloiding. And that's all I do, really. That's my beauty routine. Drink your water, cream your skin, mind your business.
I mean, I'm going to use that. I'm taking it with me into the outside world.
You could get it on a t-shirt.
It's very, 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 it's wisdom. It's total wisdom.
It's the deep magic, Sally. It's the deep magic.
It's deep. One thing I will say, though, and I've written this before about body cream, by and large, the best body creams are by black-owned brands because white women don't use body cream. And I have to use body cream. I use so much of it.
Yeah.
And most white people don't use body cream regularly, which I just find so alarming.
It's mental. And we cream our skin.
I can't live
babies.
Without.
Yeah.
Yes, I can't live without.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, when you have a baby in a black family, you have a baby, you cream your... You cream the baby, and then as soon as the baby's old enough, they learn to cream their own skin, and we cream our skin twice a day. I mean, you know, melanin helps, obviously, but, you know, people always go, why do black people look young? Why is our skin good? Well, it's because we cream our skin every single day.
Respect for moisturizer.
Yeah, respect the skin, respect for moisturizing. You know, and you don't need to spend millions of pounds on it. It just needs to have a good base and be a nourishing, good cream. Drykin is the one. Drykin. I literally cannot recommend it highly enough. I'll send you a link.
Not only will we put it in the show notes, but I will be putting it in my basket.
And put it in your basket, Sally. You're going to, and then message me after a month and tell me what, go on.
Any rich, heavy body cream I want always. That's what I'm looking for, always.
You're going to love it.
I ask everybody this, and I feel like I'm going to know your answer because you're such a kind... you're one of the most positive people I know. But nonetheless, answer me as honestly as you can.
Yeah.
What do you now think, at the age of 62, as this massively loved and desired star... What do you think and how do you feel when you look in the mirror?
I'm feeling pretty good at the moment, actually. I've lost quite a lot of weight and I've been battling with my weight for years, obviously. And I had a hysterectomy, which helped enormously because I had this terrible fibroids. I think that was the last time we spoke, actually. I think I had 15 fibroids that they had to take out. And one of them was 13 centimetres long and I had 15 of them. So that helped enormously. And I train a lot, I do all sorts of things. I've just come off Monjaro, which I did to get the last 2 stone off. And right now I look in the mirror and I feel like I'm in my best self. I feel like I've got my body back to where it's naturally meant to be. I feel like I've had my knee done, I've had my wounds, so I just all the things that I needed to do, I feel like I've done. I feel like I've been building myself back up brick by brick, sort of operation. I've had quite a lot of operations in the last couple of years, but they've all been things that would make me better. They weren't like dealing with an illness. They were like, I had to get my knee sorted, I had to get the fibroid sorted. So I've just been dealing with all the health things that kind of build up as you get older. And I've been, every time I have something done, I feel like I step more into my health and step more into my power. And right now I feel magnificent. And when I look in the mirror, I feel like I'm seeing the best version of me that there's ever been in my life. I feel like I've realizing my full potential. I feel healthy. I feel strong. I feel clear. And I feel like the future is very bright.
I agree. You are magnificent completely. Not that I ever had any doubts, but I would never have asked you about this because it's absolutely none of my business, but you've just committed an act of total kindness by saying you were on Mounjaro, because I just feel so many women are being made to feel ashamed, embarrassed, and awful about this.
It's like, piss off, leave us alone. Do you know, it's like if you ever had to battle trying to get a stone off your backside that you can't get to leave your bum, you know, getting up every morning and training, protein shake, bit of broth, da-da-da, you know what I mean? And then you get on the scales and you've lost half a pound in 2 weeks. It's just like, So Mounjaro just has helped me get over that last hump. I just think it's brilliant. And I think it's an aid. I don't think it's a way of life. I don't think anybody wants to be on that for the rest of their lives. But it's absolutely, I speak very freely about it. I mean, Serena Williams was talking about it the other day and people have been giving her shit. It's like, first of all, don't come for Serena. Right.
Well,
first
no. Of all, there are some Serena. People who are untouchable.
First of all, leave Serena alone. Secondly, she's allowed to be honest. It's like I think that we live in a funny time where everybody's supposed to be really honest, and then you're honest and people go, oh, well, why is she doing that? It's like, look, this is my life. This is who I am. This is what I've done. And I'm not going to lie about, I'm not going to pretend I've suddenly lost another 2 stone because I found some magic bullet. You know, that's just not what happened. I went to the doctor, he gave me Mounjaro, it's bloody marvellous, and now I'm off it, and I've got to my goal weight, and that feels great. Getting to your goal weight if you're trying to lose weight is a brilliant thing. It's like a moment, you undermarket, you get your jeans on, and you get on with your life and skip down the road. Hooray. I train, I eat well, I love food, I love my life, I love exercising, and I feel like I'm really healthy, you know, and I don't feel stuck. There's nothing worse than feeling stuck with weight. It's a terrible
thing. But stuck in life, generally.
Feeling
stuck is hideous.
It's just awful. And feeling unempowered and unable to make anything shift or any meaningful change. So I give thanks for the old money J, or the pens, as we call them.
I've loved talking to you today, but here's the thing. You are a person who I just always love talking to.
Oh, thanks.
You're one of those, you're one of those people that just makes people feel good about the world and being alive as a result of contact with you. I meant what I said at the top. You are a legit national treasure because of that, and because, of course, your intelligence, your talent, your skill. But as a person, you are a slightly magical person, Andy. And
oh,
I'm so glad you came on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for your time.
I want to say before we leave that I have had quite a turbulent couple of weeks with the current social and political climate.
Bloody hell. Say that again.
It's been absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, you probably saw it on my Facebook the other day, and I said, I'm simultaneously heartbroken, and on the other hand, I wish somebody would try me. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, we are not our ancestors. I'll take you out, motherfucker. Do you know what I mean? Just stop with the bullshit. But I just want to say to you, to me, to everybody, just remember that we have each other, and there are more of us than there are of them. We are legion. We are powerful. Our community, our heart, our art is our gift. Our capacity to unite is the most powerful weapon we have. And to fight back is to be together, to do, to have this kind of connection, to cook for each other, to take moments with each other and do something beautiful for somebody you love or a stranger. That's how you fight back against that horrible barrage of terrible noise that is out in the street right now. They make a lot of noise, but it doesn't mean there's more of them. They're just drunk and they're stupid.
Right? They're drunk and they're stupid.
They're drunk and they're stupid and they're loud. But don't ever forget that we are legion and we are strong and we have each other. That's all I wanted to say.
I mean, I don't want to say anything more about it after that, because that's a perfect way to end. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank
you all so much for listening. If you want more conversations with other brilliant women like Andy, not there's anyone quite like her, please go back into the archive and listen to those. And please like, subscribe, leave reviews. It all helps. But thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in the next conversation. Lots of love. Bye. Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.